All right, welcome everybody. Tonight we are tackling Parshas Ki Tetzeh, which is this is Parsha, and the title class is Tom Ford Upgrades the Construction Workers' Look. All right, obviously you see the connection. I think we're done here. Yeah. All right, so let us go to the videotape. All right, what are they called? Tom Ford, the world's best dressed man. All right. Okay, we'll do a little share screen. We'll allow it to load. Here we go.
Conrad came in, and I don't think he has any idea how handsome he is. Very handsome, Conrad.
Yeah. Thank you.
You are. You're hiding it under all this.
Yeah, very handsome.
He's a construction worker. He wants to own his own construction company. You could get Catherine Zeta-Jones. Yeah, once we clean you up.
Oh, the hair was so oily.
I'm serious. Hand disinfectant and a towel.
My intuition, I think, when I first saw him was like, oh, we're going to get rid of the beard, we're going to cut his hair short. And you're like, no, keep that. Keep that, like, saltiness, you know, keep that masculineness. But I think about what he was wearing, and he was wearing this kind of, like, printed sweatshirt and baggy sweatpants. And
he was
and
wearing
sneakers and, you know.
My personal style is like chaos.
We wanted to keep all these guys' personalities. We didn't want to change the personalities. Yeah. We wanted to keep who they are, but just, you know, help them find the best version of themselves. Yeah. So we wanted to keep him casual in a way, but just really upgrade him so that he looks like the guy who really owns the company.
By putting him in this beautiful, you know, top coat and turtleneck and pants, you're not trying to take him out of his element.
You know, in the vernacular of his world, but obviously a very luxe version. Conrad was a great pleasure because once we had him dressed, I think he felt very, very proud, and he really projected into the camera. He was so easy to photograph.
Yes, I think I am good model. Today, Tom Ford was really professional. It's a pleasure to work with him.
I think men in our culture rarely get the kind of attention that we paid to all of these guys during this process. Women are very used to having men say to them, wow, you look so great, you look beautiful. I don't think most women say that to men very much. So if you're a woman and you're watching this, say something nice to the guy in your life.
All right. Okay. The wisdom of Tom Ford. You heard it here first. All right, so let's get into it. Let us build the bridge from the Tom Ford insight to the Parsha. Step one, how did Tom Ford, famous fashion designer, or as he is known, the world's best dressed man, assess Conrad Ruzicki, construction worker? How do you assess him?
What do you mean?
He came in. He gave a rather brutal assessment. Scott, you're on mute, so I don't hear you.
Oh, he's a good looking guy. He just doesn't know how to dress properly.
How did he basically describe his current state of dress?
I forget what he said, but basically disheveled and.
An absolute disaster.
Disaster, yeah.
Like, in other words, the most demeaning assessment, like, completely, I mean, because he came in there with, like, sweats and a jersey and a hoodie.
Well,
he's a construction worker. Yeah. I mean, whatever. He's not, you know, he's looking for function, not form. All right. So... But apparently Conrad wants to be, who's a construction, wants to actually one day own his own construction company. So what problem is Tom Ford assessing that he has to overcome?
He doesn't look like he's like an owner. He looks like he's a worker.
Correct. You gotta, if you want the part, you gotta dress the part. Nobody's gonna take
the part you want, not the part you have.
Exactly. Because nobody can take Conrad seriously. Employees, possible partners, investors.
Banks trying to get a loan.
Yeah, not happening. He's basically, he's already failed before he started. Nope. Even if he's a genius, he's not gonna make it. So therefore, now, which I guess, now this is a GQ series, and Tom Ford always asks the people who are participating in the makeover, what do you want to do? What's your personal vision of yourself in the next 3 years? Why does he care? What is he, a career counselor?
Well,
all right, Masha. Go ahead, Masha. Babakasha.
Oh no, I was just gonna say, I'm guessing that he, like, in keeping with what we were just saying, that he, you know, dressed for the job you want, blah blah blah. Like, he wants whatever look he creates for each person to match what their goal is for themselves.
Now, correct. Now, but what makes that. But instead of it, now, how do you differentiate, here's the good thing, a costume versus a proper outfit? There's an important element that he looks for.
Well, a costume is, you're not you, you're dressing as someone else. It's like a costume of like an owner, but like you're not like trying to be an owner, or like dressing them nicely. You're trying to bring out, like, you know, give him like the inner confidence to be that person that he's.
So what there is, by the way, the guy's, I mean, he has a fashion, fashion empire. Okay. I think his financial net worth is $500 million. So he did, I don't know if you guys caught this. Now, if I were, so a simple, based upon the application that we said, oh, dress the part you want. Oh, so where he should? Why don't they put him on a three-piece suit to make him into look like a banker or look like a serious owner of companies? Why didn't he go that way?
Because you have to take the person's goals into account.
No, he says he wants to be an owner of a construction company. Why didn't he give him a suit? They're owners of construction companies that wear a suit. Why didn't he suit him up? He said something. It was very quick, but
it would have gone too far, too fast. It would have, like, you know, stretching a rubber band. You know what I mean? Like, you want to stretch it like a little bit, not like all the way, and that would snap.
Well, how do you know when you're stretching it and not stretching it too far? What was the unspoken principle in his fashion?
He's a construction worker. He probably generally doesn't wear a lot of suits. So maybe if, like, you put him in a suit, he would have, like, been uncomfortable, whereas, like, a sweater and a top coat is a little bit more, you know, comfortable. It would have been more relaxed.
Well, 1 second. Is a goal here comfort, or is a goal trying to achieve your goals?
A little bit of both, I'd say.
No, he doesn't care about the comfort part at all.
Well, maybe it's...
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, Masha.
Sorry, I was just going to say... That the level of formality, yeah, maybe it's not so much about the comfort, but maybe the relaxed look, like Scott was saying, is that, I don't know, like it goes more with what he's doing, or maybe it's closer to where he is right now. I'm not sure.
He said a phrase. It was very rather quick. He said, "I want to bring out the most luxe version of him." In other words, he wants to marry two. He, in other words, part of his fashion idea. I mean, by the way, you see that, you know, what kind of chachma, what kind of wisdom the guy has. So he's like this. He has a goal. He wants to be a construction company owner. Okay, that's one goal. Now, if you just dress him up and it's inauthentic, then it's a costume. Then he's acting as if. But it's not like that. He wants to, he has a much more subtle idea. He wants to take the personality that is and create the, let's call it the best version of that. You know what I'm saying? He's not trying to change the guy. He's not going to change the guy's personality and somehow he's dressing now as a British banker. That would be ridiculous. He might even make him look good in it, but it would come across as, remember, he's not a mannequin. The guy's, as the guy said, he's a good looking guy. You can probably put anything on him. He will look good. That's not the chop. That's a unsophisticated appreciation of what Tom's doing. Tom is recognizing like this. He has to marry two things. He has a career goal, but then he has a personality. It has to be a blossoming of the person. So within Conrad, who he is now, what would be appropriate? So he got casual, but the most expensive possible casual. So it was a nice pair of slacks. It was a gorgeous sweater, a turtleneck. So there's no tie, and it wasn't a jacket, but it was sort of like that pea coat, kind of, I don't know what exact terminology is. So he looks stunning. Now, again, you're getting the benefit of, you know, the GQ unlimited, you know, fashion budget. So that outfit probably cost $5,000, you know? So, but my point being is that he's trying to weave those two elements together. Now, when they gave him the ultimate haircut by the top fashion haircut guy, and they gave him the facial by the facial team, and they trimmed him up and looked it up, and they gave him up, and then he's now taking these awesome pictures that he looks, you know, magnificent in, right? How did Conrad feel?
He felt great.
That was like he was like rocking it.
Felt like $1 million. Looked like it too.
You know, he felt like the boss. But it was appropriate. So that was the so that is the power of clothing. Now, obviously, a limitation is that, it's very nice. You want to be the owner of a construction company. You can have Tom Ford dress you every single day. You also need the wisdom and the know-how and the experience to be able to do that. This is solving one problem. In other words, in a certain sense, the famous phrase, clothes makes the man, it does not give them all the experience. So it's an important component, but it's something which is very critical. Now, the reason why I'm bringing this up, because our Torah has, interestingly enough, this week's Parsha has a rather mysterious mitzvah about clothing, which we're going to get to right now, which we're going to tackle. Here we go. I'm going to share a screen. All right, everybody can see the sheet?
Yeah.
All right, beautiful. All right, Scott, read the Pasuk.
Pasuk 11. Pasuk 11. You shall not wear a mixed garment, wool and linen together.
Okay, so the Hebrew, lo tilba shatnez, which means mixed garment.
Shatnez, it's the...
Otherwise known as shatnez, okay? Yeah. Shatnez. The mitzvah, the prohibition, comes from this week's Parsha. Okay, it's actually mentioned all the time in the Torah. All right, so what is the obvious question? What is the obvious... when you read that pasuk in the Torah, what comes to mind? What challenge comes to mind? Masha.
It seems a little random.
Yeah.
Like, what's the big deal?
Right. Wool is cool. Wool is kosher. Lid is kosher. Mixing them all together, I got a non-kosher outfit. You know, I understand kosher food, or maybe I don't, but now is kosher clothes? And does the Torah give us a reason for the prohibition?
No, it's a hulk.
No, it's a chok. In fact, it's one of the top five classic chukim, which means a chok means a law whose rationale is not readily apparent. It's hidden. Okay. All right. So the Rambam, we're going to read some of the Rambam. There are a number of schools of thought. There are a number of schools of thought theorizing. So, Julie, can you read?
I can try. Let me see. I see the screen. Yeah.
I'm gonna make it a little bigger. Hold on. Let me just line it up here for you. I hope one second it's too big. One second. All right, there we go. All right, take it away. This is from the Ram has a Sefer HaMitzvot, the Book of Mitzvot, where he lists all 613 mitzvot, which are composed of 248 positive commandments, mitzvot you must do, at least the Jewish people must do, and 365 thou shalt not. Okay, negative, what we call negative commandments. Go ahead, Julie, take it away.
He prohibited?
Yeah.
He prohibited us from wearing a garment woven of woolen linen like that which would be worn by the idolatrous priests of that time. And that is his saying, you shall not wear shotness. And this practice is famous today among the idolatrous priests in Egypt. And one who transgresses this negative commandment is liable for lashes. And the regulations of this commandment have already been explained in Tractate Kihlaim, Shabbat, Sota, and Mechot.
Okay, good. So the Rambam, by the way, puts in a reason. He just puts it in. What does he say as a reason? We're going to expand upon this reason. Julie, well, he just hopped in a reason. Why did the Torah prohibit shotness? Because? Right there. What does he say the reason is?
We would be worn by an idolatrous priest.
Right. You're wearing the clothing of the style and the fashion of idolatrous priests of the time of the Torah. And then he adds in another little comment, and the practice is famous today among the idolatrous priests in Egypt. That's 12th century Egypt. What's the obvious question on the Rambam?
The Torah was before the idolatry in Egypt, especially. So it wouldn't make sense if Hashem is telling us. It's a chok. There's no reason. Hashem says there's no reason. It's a chok. So what's he trying to give a reason for?
Well, he's speculating, but the question is, I mean, how is he so confident? Where did he get that from? The Torah doesn't say it. Then the Rambam adds more onto that in his Guide to the Perplexed. Julie, take us home over here. Go ahead.
We have explained in our large work that it is prohibited to round the corners of the head and to mar the corners of the beard.
I'm just going to translate the English into English because it's sometimes hard. There's a prohibition for a guy to shave his hair. You know, there's a prohibition that you can't shave off your payas. In other words, you can't just get like a mushroom, or the part of the hair from the top of the ear down to the jawbone has to remain at least intact. You can't shave that off. That's a Torah prohibition. Nor can you shave with a razor your beard. Okay? And now he goes to reason. Now the Torah, again, does not state a reason. What does he say?
Because it was a custom of idolatrous priests. For the same reason, the wearing of garments made of linen and wool is prohibited. The heathen priests adorned themselves with garments containing vegetable and animal material, whilst they held in their hand a seal made of a mineral. This you find written in their book.
Okay, so the Rambam takes three mitzvot and he makes them into a constellation. The Torah prohibits a number of practices, which was the fashion of the idolatrous priests in the time of the Torah. Now, I just want to parenthetically, that's his reason. Other people give different reasons, but that's okay. We're going to analyze this approach. Okay. This is one school of thought. Or we keep on going.
Sorry, Rabbi, I wasn't clear. The shotness, there's payas, and what's the other?
Baltakif is the cutting with a razor of the facial hair.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so he puts all three as being part of the dress or the manner of dress of the idolatrous priests. Okay.
I thought payas was a custom, not a halakha.
No, there's a okay. Julie, I'm so happy you asked that question, because that is something which it gets a little confusing. So the Torah prohibition is I'm not allowed to shave off my payas, which means I can't have I can't get a, you know, using one of those shavers. I can't get a zero or even maybe even a one and shave down the side of my top of my head over here. You know what I'm saying? From looking over here, from the jawbone, to say the top of the ear, this area must have hair on it. If I shave that down, like you'll see people that just like have a mohawk or just have a mushroom style, or they do the old shave off all their hair because they got, they're mostly bald, so it'll look, instead of the spotty hair look, they're going for the full head look. From a Torah prohibition, that's a Torah prohibition. You got to leave some hair, at least in those areas. Okay? So that, now, there's an additional custom among Hasidim and Yemenite Jews, which is to take that hair and grow it out. Like a long, you know, like a little, like, you know, like a, what we call, what people call like the side locks. You know, whenever, you know, Hasidim, they'll wear hair from this area, and they'll grow it out as a long strand of series of hair. That's what people call payas. That is a custom. That is not an obligation, okay? The certain communities wear what they call long payas. But every Jewish male, not woman, female, cannot shave this part of the hair. That's biblical payas. Julie, is that clear?
Yes.
Okay, good. Now, we're going to take a pause. We're going to get back to pay. We're going to get back to the pay, to the shatnez. I want to question number 8. Why would we be attracted to that outfit, to this shatnez outfit? In other words, let's say this was worn by the idolaters. What do wearers of crystal jewelry believe about their power? Does everybody know about crystals? Did anybody know about crystal jewelry?
Vaguely.
No, I'm not familiar.
Okay, so if you Google crystal jewelry, okay, there is a belief that it will provide a whole host of benefits.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, well, you know, it will affect your chakras. It'll balance your energy. It'll ward off negative energy. It's like people from that energy school. All right. So the people who are big into the crystals, they wear crystal a necklace, and they use it not just because it's an item of beautification, but there's a belief, which is not found empirically, but they believe that it has curative powers. Okay. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of people in America that religiously wear and utilize crystals as a way to, you know, create internal harmony, channel the energies, ward off negativity. Okay, you may have. Have you ever met such people? I'll just pause on that. Have you met people who are like that?
I've never met them, but I know people spend tons of money on crystals and for their homes and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a whole, there's a part of people and all people to varying degrees that want to have, basically you want to call it enchanted clothing or enchanted jewelry that has curative powers. All right. So that's easy. That's like, and if you're in LA, or in San Francisco, or from the West Coast, from Seattle, huge in the crystals, huge, okay? Enchanted jewelry, okay? Now let's move a little closer to our community. People who wear chamsas, does everybody know what a chamsa is?
Like a hand?
Right, it is the hand. Let me just bring one up for everybody to...
wards off like the evil eye, right?
There you go. Chamsa
I do own one of those, not to wear, but like I have a little Hamza, figurine thingy.
Oh yeah, they're used for decoration also.
Right.
I mean, maybe it's not just anyway.
But what is the belief of what is the belief?
It's God's hand, right? Or something like that.
Yeah, it protects you from the Ayin Hara. It's from the from the Sephardic. Here, I'm going to go to a share screen. Here we go. There you go. Everybody see these? Good examples. Cham says this is like a particularly, you know, and if you get into the you get into some opal. Oh, pretty. Okay, very nice jewelry. Gold is also good. There you go. And then in it, it's got a little eye, so it's like double. It's got a double protection. It's got the hand and the eye. Does anybody know where that came from? First of all, is a chamsa in the Torah?
Probably not.
Is it in the Navi?
Maybe.
Nope. Is it in the Ketuvim, in the writings, in the like the five Megillot and Tehillim? Nope. Is it in the Mishnah?
No.
Is it in the Talmud?
No.
Is it in the rabbinic writings?
No. Did it stem from paganism?
It did.
It's not in the Kabbalah at all?
It comes from...
Really?
Yeah. It came from Arab pagans. But we live with them. You know what I'm saying? You can't live with other nations and not pick stuff up. And it's something that, now why do we pick it? Why was that picked up? And I'll add another thing. Let's do another one.
So does that mean if you have one, which I do, you're not supposed to wear it?
If you're asking me from a halachic standpoint, it would be better to throw it out.
Wow.
Because it's really from a pagan source. It's got no Jewish source.
They're so popular. They're everywhere.
Ah! Well, how? Now, how did that happen? Next one. Here's my next artifact.
Isn't it similar to
so many?
What about this? What's this?
Red string?
Yeah, the red string bendel, and it's got on top of that, it's got the little eye in there.
Correct. Thank you for bringing that up because I didn't want to start any trouble by bringing that one up. So
it's interesting. Is the red string mentioned in rabbinic writing?
It's red. A red something is mentioned as an ayin hara. Actually, it's an ayin hara to have it. It brings in the evil eye.
It's actually written. It's written in the Tosefta. What is the Tosefta? The Tosefta is what's called the Mishnah outtakes. In other words, when they get Rabbi Yehuda Nasi gathered all the various, he's the editor in chief. He didn't write the Mishnah, so him and his team got down and codified the Mishnah around the year 200. There were statements of the rabbis that didn't make it into the Mishnah. They're called the Tosefta, but they still have significance. So one of the Toseftas from the tractate of Shabbat, the seventh chapter, talks about a red string that people used to wrap around their finger. And guess what they called it? The Darkei Amori, the ways of the Amorite. So we see three things here. We see crystals among the New Age Americans and others. We see Chamsas, which is super popular throughout the Middle East, Jew and non-Jew alike. It's not limited to Jew because it's from Arabs. And three is the red string, which you also find Hindus and other people also have that as a warding off the evil eye. So why is that? Why is it so ever-present? And how did it get stuck into Judaism? How did it get, I don't mean to Judaism, but within the Jewish people? Again, I'm not here to criticize people. I'm just trying to understand how did that sociologically get, you know, absorbed into our culture?
My guess would be that other than what you just said before about us living how the Jews have lived near other nations and taken on some of their customs. I wonder if it's because we don't pray to idols, but maybe there are some people who like having some sort of a physical symbol. I mean, maybe it's the same as wearing a Jewish star or like something physical that gives you protection. Although I don't know how that differs from like a mezuzah. I'm not sure.
Now people don't wear, I don't think people wear a Star of David for protection. They view it as it's a proud statement of identity.
Well, that's true.
Now people sometimes wear a mezuzah. They do wear it for sort of like an amulet kind of thing. That is a phenomena. When I grew up, that was like a big thing. Like among non-Orthodox Jews, they wear a little mezuzah, a little gold mezuzah. I don't know if you've seen that. I mean, it's not as popular as it was back in the 70s and 80s. Anyways, the point of the matter is that the key point is that is the appeal. In other words, this desire to have special clothes that endow an enchanted element, a magical element that provides protection, is something which is universal. In the time of the Torah, according to the Rambam, at least from his theory, this was about channeling certain power. The shatnez clothing was a clothing of power, of sort of an enchantment. We're going to get into that more deeply. Now, here's my question. We're going to get to that in the Rambam second. But how would Tom Ford explain why people want their power to be expressed in their dress and hairstyle? In other words, why is it important that your power be expressed in your hairstyles and in your dress in general? We'll go to a general point.
You get confidence from it?
You get confidence on it, and what else? Why do you get confidence of it from it?
Because it's like a physical thing that you can touch and see.
Right. So you feel empowered, and you also notice that it gives it when you walk into a room and you're really well dressed and you feel very confident, people react to that confidence and they treat you differently. So having clothing that radiates power is a universal thing. The king does not wear sweats and a t-shirt. He wears a crown. He wears royal garb. He's there to manifest that he is, in fact, in charge. So in modern times, they have different clothing. We literally call it, what do we call it? The power suit. Okay? So that literally, I mean, I can't say any better than that. So what if you start to analyze fashion in a deeper way, fashion is a very complex institution. And all kinds of signaling is communicated in the way you dress. So if you want to show power, I mean, why is a guy going to spend $10,000 on a Rolex, $20,000 on a Rolex? Even if he's wearing a golf shirt and a pair of khaki pants, why is that one article of jewelry ever so critical? What is that? What? Go ahead, Masha.
Sorry, it's a status symbol. I didn't mean to put it on.
Yeah, so unpack that. What does it mean? So you're talking to the guy, and you notice the Rolex. So what goes through your mind?
I mean, Rolex has a certain prestige about it, I guess. Like it's a certain, it makes a statement about who the person is and maybe how successful they are or stuff like that.
100%. It basically communicates to the observer, I'm a successful person. I have a lot of money. I may even have power. That's what it is. And these things are very critical. The entire luxury market, which is many, many billions of dollars for males and females, is all about ways to signal the person's rank in society. Okay? Very critical. Even though you can get the exact same item for, you know, what they call, you know, for example, everybody heard of Men's Warehouse?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
There was a time in America where one out of five American men owned a Men's Warehouse suit. 20%. Okay. Now, their whole market was that they would go to a company like Macy's or Hart & Schaffner, some of the larger suit makers, and they say like this: you have your suit and you're selling it for $500. We'll order 10,000 of them. Make them white label. In other words, take off your label and sell them to me for $100 less. That's basically the entire economic model of Men's Warehouse. The power of the white label. So you can wear the exact same suit. So here's my caution to you. If a person recognizes the identical Hart & Schaffner or Pierre Cardin or whatever the name on Nino Cerruti, whatever the, you know, suits of the 70s and 80s, whatever, 90s, whatever it was, fill in blank, it's identical. It's literally the exact same suit. But what does it lack?
The name.
It doesn't got the label. It's got a generic label that says Men's Warehouse, which is many things, but sexy and innate. But it's exactly, but yet people went out to the brand name and got the identical suit. And they're paying literally $100, $200, $300, many hundreds of dollars just for that label. It's an amazing thing. So everybody's happy. The people who had the top line suit, they were getting people who needed that certain measure of status and significance and rank. And Men's Warehouse was able to carve out a very successful business. That's the story of Men's Warehouse. The power of the white label. Because people, they're people who are the value shoppers. They don't, I don't need to be a big shot. I just need to walk into the office looking like a mensch. And I like to, and I do like to save $100, $200 for that expensive suit, for a basic suit that looks good. I don't need the Cavo. I just need the suit. That's it. Now, okay, here's the question. Now we get into some of the, we're going one step deeper. Let's go into the question over here. Question number 10. Assuming the Rambam is correct as to the theory of why the Torah forbade us wearing garments of wool and linen, in what way might the dress of idolatrous priests be similar to crystals and chamzas? What do you guys say? How is it similar to the chamza and to the crystal?
They're just shiny little objects.
They wore, you know, wool, which is, you know, and linen, which is basically you take flax and you make it and you beat it until it becomes a linen thread, and they happen to blend them together.
So, I mean, maybe. Oh, I'm sorry.
Good.
I really don't mean to keep talking over you, but anyway. So maybe it's that. Well, especially since you just told us that the chamza comes from actual idolatry, but also just the fact that maybe we should be kind of, rather than relying on whether it's clothes or some sort of an object for some sort of a magical power, like we should just be relying on Hashem.
That's the message of the Torah. The Torah wants a person to remove security in things that are false and provide and get security from Hashem and the way that Hashem has educated us to live a successful life. But the idolatrous guy, in order to promote his belief among the people, what does he want to show? He wants to show power. He wants to show magic. He wants to communicate a way to, he's trying to sell empowerment. He's selling empowerment, that he's powerful and that you, by joining him, will become equally powerful. by wearing special magic clothing. Now, here's interesting chap. The Rambam in the Mor Avuchim, he wrote it that the guy would wear garments from vegetable, which is a linen. Linen grows from the ground. Animal, that's the wool, comes from sheep. And they would hold simultaneously a seal, a piece of rock made of a mineral. Why did they want to have all three? What are they communicating to their public? Why specifically might the priest want to wear garments from all categories of materials, animal, vegetable, mineral, to channel power? What are they really saying?
That's like being all powerful.
In what sense? Go ahead, unpack that.
Meaning that it's different elements that are found in nature. And so if they use all of them together and use them as something that has magical powers, that sends the message that they have like unlimited power or something like that.
Exactly. In other words, that they're gathering the power from the animal kingdom, the earth, from the vegetable world, and as well as the mineral world. They're channeling this very significant power. And from linen, from wool, from the linen and wool, which is from the animal kingdom and the vegetable kingdom, you know, that they are sort of gathering that sort of the fertility and the life force. So that has brings to mind when presented a certain way as being a very, makes them a very powerful being. Now we can understand another thing, something fresh. We don't wear that. Okay. But we can now with this see an additional idea. Why does at least Jewish men wear tefillin and tzitzis? Why were we mandated at least to wear tzitzit if we have a four corner garment and we try to do that? A Jewish man during the week has to wear tefillin, at least in the morning, once a day. Now you can see how there's a new dimension of the talis and tefillin going on. If you see it from the prism of shatness. What do you guys say?
Well, it's distinguishing the Jewish people from other nations.
So how, okay, in what way?
Because you're like outwardly saying like these are my values.
Exactly. They're not objects of power. They're objects of communicating ideas, because in the tefillin is the four paragraphs from the Torah. Not just any paragraphs, the two paragraphs of Shema, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokim Hashem Echad, and the second paragraph of Hayim Shemoa, and the two paragraphs which compose the 13th chapter of Shemot. Kadesh Likol Bechor, when the Jews left Egypt, they had an obligation to sanctify firstborn to God. And then when they came to land, the idea of the Pidyon. But basically it refers to Hashem, the liberation from Egypt, God is unity, the loving God, and the idea that there is reward and punishment. So we're doing two things. We are blocking the desire to wear enchanted, magical, powerful clothing or jewelry, and wearing instead clothing or art or jewelry or adornments which communicate concept. The tzitzis are wrapped in a certain way. You look at the tzitzis, and it says literally in the Torah, you'll see them and remember all the mitzvahs of God. So one, it shows you about basically a completely paradigmatic sea change about what is powerful in dress. We wear dress to communicate and reflect idea and ideals. The pagan wears dress to communicate power through magic. And the Torah, at least the Rambam's vision, there are other people have different theories, but his theory was that it was a common practice among the idolaters to specifically wear garments woven together with linen and wool to communicate, I have dominion over these forces, and I can channel that power through my mentality, through my magic. And this mentality of shodness, is, at least from the Rambam's perspective, still exists with many people who are still wearing crystals, which is to channel power of various kinds. And of course, is even in the Jewish community, we picked up from the various nations, the Chamsa and the Red Bindle, it's to ward off, it has a magical force field. So that's a very common phenomenon. Now, I want to go into another dimension of dress. We got 10 more minutes. Mash, can you read? Can you see the screen?
Yeah, where it starts, Hilchot Deot.
Yeah, good.
Okay. A Torah sage's clothing should be attractive and clean. It is forbidden that a blood or fat stain or the like be found on his garment. He should not wear regal garb, such as clothes of gold and purple, which draw everyone's attention, nor the dress of the poor, which shames its wearers, but attractive garments of the middle range. Should I keep going or?
Yeah, keep on going.
Okay. His flesh should not be visible under his clothing, as is the case when one wears exceptionally sheer linen garments produced in Egypt. His clothes should not drag on the ground like the dress of the haughty, but should extend to the heel, and his sleeves should extend to his fingers. He should not let his cloak hang down, for that creates an impression of haughtiness, except on the Sabbath if he has no change of cloak. In the summer, he should not wear shoes that have often been mended and have many patches. He may do so in the rainy season if he's poor.
Okay. So the Rambam articulates that for the Torah scholar, and to a certain degree, perhaps others, have an obligation of clothing. So what styles of clothing does the Torah not want us to wear? Clothing that does what?
Makes us look either very poor or very ostentatious.
Exactly. What's the one Hebrew word that would appropriately apply to this manner of dress?
Huh. Oh, tzniut.
Tzniut. Tzniut is about tzniut is a mentality of showing of not trying to seek the spotlight, of trying to gain everybody's attention. And that applies to men and women equally. And with the Talmud Chacham, who has a responsibility in the community, he has a prohibition. He can't walk. Why can't he wear, let's say he's got a blog of ketchup on his white shirt. Why can't he have that? Okay, he was having some French fries and he had a French fry accident. Who has not had a French fry accident? We all have. Okay. Sometimes it rolls down the old shirt. Why is he, why must he immediately change?
It's not respectable.
Yeah. Since he has to be a role model, he can't look like a slob. And a person, if he has a stain on his shirt, he's going to look like a, now what kind of, let's say, outfit is he supposed to wear? High-end Armani, low-end, I don't know, what do you want to call it, Sears? a mid-level garment. What's his obligation? Scott?
To be an example for the community.
And what level of dress does he have to wear?
He's got to look like he's got his game together.
Okay, but he has to wear attractive garments, but what price point? What level?
A level that the rest of the community can afford, not something that would separate him from everyone else.
Well, it says attractive garments of the middle range.
Right.
He's got
nice, but affordable.
What the Rambam talking about is a gi here. Is the problem about how much it's going to cost? What is he supposed to try to avoid?
I don't think it's the cost. He can't look like like out of place, I guess. Like he's better than everyone.
Right. So he can't look like he's lording over everybody, that he's got he's wearing the
right.
$4,000 Armani suit. Can't be like, whoa. What's going on over here? right? And simultaneously, he can't look super schleppy. The people are like, he looks terrible. You know what I mean? Basically, has to basically be, in a certain sense, dress, you know, nice. He's got to be, the goal is presentable, nice, and basically, you know, now he can show a little style, but he's basically within the middle range. And he can't be arrogant, and he can't wear sheer, can't be, he can't be suggestive clothing, or he can't walk around, you know, like a tank top. You know what I'm saying? But he can't, you know, be dressed in a haughty manner. He's got a everything. What now? You know, yeah. What would it be if this is a higher standard for the Torah scholar, but for regular Jewish guy walk around on a hot day without a shirt? Is that would that be just wearing shorts? Would that be appropriate? I'm not talking about the pool. I'm talking about down the block. Would that be? No, because he's obviously if he's not wearing a shirt, he's got the pecs to the pecs and the abs to present. So that would be not sneeze. That would be wrong for even a regular Jew. Okay, so basically, just to summarize, put it all together, we're going to do our three scenarios and we're going to call it a night. Basically, our clothing should be not magical. It should be modest and appropriate. It should be clean. It should be middle of the road. It should be attractive and not provocative. But other than that, you want to wear a blue suit, you want to wear a black suit, a woman wants to wear a black dress, a blue dress, it doesn't make a difference. It's got to fit into the thing. Now, with women, there's additional definitions of what is suggestive. Those are what people conventionally call the SNES rules, but fundamentally, it's there's certain showing of their parts of their body was viewed as intrinsically sexual and provocative. So, but again, the same principle of SNES applies. Okay, so I want to here's a good question: is there a specific Jewish ethnic style mandating clothing?
You mean like Western? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, any kind. Is there a particular? Is there specifically Jew clothing?
It depends on who you ask, because I feel like people in some communities do make an effort to look different.
Like there's like a Hasidic style.
Right, so, I was waiting for that. So in the Hasidic community since the 19th century, they elected as part of creating a unique group. Specifically, part of their strategy of isolationism, sort of their dealing with modernity, they decided to adopt the clothing of essentially the 18th century Polish landowner, which is the black outfit,
black suit.
Well, they had a split with a rekel, you know, they would wear not just a suit, but a chassid doesn't wear a suit. He wears a long coat, black, white shirt, no tie, pants typically, and then typically will wear socks that will extend up. So if you look, it's very similar to the way the Polish aristocracy dressed in the 18th century. They selected that as being part of their group identity and part of their way to, when they dealt with modernity and to keep their sense of identity in a fast changing world, that was their strategy. But if you look through the entire Talmud and Jewish law, is there any, we just read, the Rambam say you have to dress like anybody? Well, how does he, you just got to dress the middle. He doesn't say, it's not, clothing changes from every society. So whatever people in England in the 15th century dressed, you just have to apply these rules. In other words, middle of the road, you know, attractive, not ostentatious, not revelatory. That's it. Even though you'd be wearing something that looked like, you know, be looking like Beethoven. You know what I mean? You'd be wearing that, you know, with a powdered wig, whatever the appropriate middle way was. If you lived in Cairo, you'd be wearing a turban. You'd be wearing a robe. And if you look at pictures and drawings of Torah personalities, they wore the dress of their society. So there is no specific outfit, yeah, we wear talis and tefillin during davening, or even, you know, but the other clothing could be whatever is our society, provided it's not shatnez and other, some specific issues, but that's it. All right, so now we're going to make some applications. Here we go. Scenario number one, Stan Amgier walks into a Macy's men's department. They're having a big suit sale. How, by with learning of the insights about shatnez and tznius, affect his choice of suit beyond not buying a shatnez suit? Price and look. What should he do? Or what should be his determinant factor? Assuming that money is not a factor. What kind of suit should he get?
A 100% wool suit. I mean,
true, but what kind? What kind of look? What kind of price?
Something nice, but, you know, not too flashy.
Yeah.
I mean,
nice.
Yeah.
That's it. Nice, not too flashy, attractive, mid-range, not over the top, not, you know, not walking in that you're going to come in there like whoa, what is Not clothing that creates the spotlight upon you, but you just look very appropriate and very nice, and style whatever you want, whatever you like. And shot is, you got to check, you know, there, that's a whole, the technicalities of that. Even 100% wool suits can still have shotness in it, and you, there's a whole, I'm not dealing with the halachic ways to, there are people who do check shotness, and certain suits, if you can call in them, you can see what brands have shotness issues. If the brand does not have shotness issues very infrequently, you don't have to get a check, because you only have to check when there's at least a 10% chance that there'll be shotness in it. Okay.
So that's, like,
good.
Coats, like winter coats, like wool coats, like you should have that check.
So you can check, but I would first, before checking, call in to the various, there's a number of shotness labs, and say, I got myself a wool coat from this particular brand. Have you had a lot of instances of shotness in it? I called in. They say, no, they'll ask you what country, very important country, what brand. And they'll say, no, we haven't had an issue. So if the answer is this brand from this country, and the answer is we've had no reports of shotness, then you don't have to check it. If they know it's an offender, then you got to bring in and get it.
What do you mean by shotness lab? Is that like a phone number or something?
Yeah, there's a couple of organizations that there are two ways of checking shotness. One is through a microscope, because you can look very carefully at the they take the different samples of the suit or garment. And they look under, and you can see that obviously something's from a wool has one look under the microscope, and linen, which is from a fibrous, you know, a flax, looks way different. So they have a way. Mm-hmm. There's a microscope way, and then there's a chemical way. So they can check by dropping in the chemical. They have a reaction. There are two kinds of, and of course each one says that their methodology is the best. Okay, I'm not getting into that. I can't. So the two schools of thought of checking for shatnez, they're both are fine. Each one says they're superior. Okay, I'm not here to, I can't, I don't know. But you call them up and they ask them information. They got, you know, check online. There's a lot of information online about that.
Okay.
Good question. Nancy Amgier has been invited to a costume party. Her friend Nancy thought it'd be funny if they dressed like nuns. How would the lessons learned from shatnez and tznius affect her choice whether to join in Nancy's costume idea? What are three other costumes Nancy would avoid? What do you think about the nun outfit?
I actually know someone in a community upstate where these two girls dressed up as nuns. Like, they dressed up as the characters from Sister Act, but maybe they were misinformed. I don't know.
Well, I'm asking you guys, what do you think?
I mean, it's just a costume. I don't know.
On Purim, even on Purim or any other time?
This is costume party.
Based on what we said today, it wouldn't be a biblical issue, but maybe it would be. Wait, would you have the name of the Rambam? But the Rambam's dressed, it's not appropriate.
Yeah, you're literally dressing like idolaters. According to most Rishonim, Christianity, which believes in the Trinity theory of God, you know, inhabiting three persons, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, that's the clothing of idolaters. That's what it is. So that would be a big no-no. People are not sensitive. Now, I also think another thing, we live in a pluralistic society. I don't think it's appropriate to make fun of other people's religion. So, you know, I don't think they should wear that. Or Santa Claus is not really that's not an idolatrous thing, but I just think maybe that's less problematic, but I just think that from a sensitivity thing, it should not be an area of, you know, making fun of people's religion. I don't, you know.
Rabbi, you didn't address this, but what about like the ways of the non-Jews, right?
Right. So there's dark Yamar or Chukas Agoyim. So that might be a Chukas Agoy issue. It might involve a biblical prohibition. Serious.
I'm saying like we stick with shoelaces, right? And certain types of clothes, right? So why wouldn't that affect? I wasn't sure to bring it up, but now I'm bringing it up.
So yeah, so that's a whole sheer. What's the ways of the idol? It's not everything that the idolater does. We do. I mean, they eat. We're allowed to eat. You know what I mean? They get dressed, but clothing, which is unique to their idolatrous service, or we're talking about a nun. They're committed to the religious practices of Catholicism. I mean, that's serious. So now, if you go been to costume parties. What other costumes should a person avoid, which is a common issue in the secular world? What other costume ideas are often worn by women at Halloween parties or just general costume parties?
The type of that don't have much fabric?
Yeah. I do not know why this is, and we could speculate, but if you go onto the costume stores, you know the stores that... Dressing up as some sort of prostitute or hooker or just very, you know.
It doesn't even have to be that. There's just like small versions of like everything.
Naughty and nice and I hate maybe to use the word sexy or sinner is a very big common theme and in letting free. And, you know, the less is more for women in many of these type of things for. And that's what the parties become anyways, most of these
things. So that's a classic element. So another aspect of dress I couldn't squeeze in this year because we're already on the overtime already, is the idea of cross-dressing. The Torah, this week's parsha, also has the prohibition of cross-dressing. Now, part of the idea of cross-dressing, there's a number of reasons, one of which is that there's a sexual component of that. And, okay, so, you know, so there's, so... Dressing up to create a sexual vibe, first of all, is a huge part of these costume parties. So Nancy should avoid all those options. You know, as you said, the naughty and nice biker, a waitress, secretary, nurse, all these different frameworks. Okay, let's go to our last one. Here we go. Stacy went to Israel and she received a skula, that means a good fortune, green string from someone near the grave of Rabbi Yonatan ben Uziel in Amuka. Amuka is near Sfat. All right, Yonatan ben Uziel wrote a commentary on the Aramaic commentary on the Tanakh. But apparently, and this is literally, by the way, this is like 50 years old, literally created by tour operators. Unbelievable. There's no source. It's not even no Hasidic source. Nothing. Sheerly made up. Okay? So what people do is they go to a Amuka, they're looking for a shidduch, and you dive in there, you put a little kfittel, you put a little note in the by the grave, and you tie a little string, and apparently there's also getting a green string. Now the green string, by the way, comes purely from the Arabs. It's a Islamic fertility string, okay? And she was told if she prays for her husband by the grave, it may be granted within a year. So what should she do with the green string?
Not wear it.
Yeah, not wear it. So my point being is that, look, we don't know if the Rambam's right or not right about the reason for shatness. It's his theory. But the idea that he's presenting about, empowerment in clothing by having enchanted or magical or spiritually powerful clothing in jewelry and strings and crystals is something that was alive and well in the time of the Torah. And even though with all our modernity is alive and well today, because here's the bottom line. No matter how confident modern man feels, we live in a world where it's very scary. And a person wants to have a physical object of security, something that they can hold on to provide personal support and empowerment. And the Torah, as Masha pointed out, is trying to educate us that we should put our security in things which is real. And the only thing that's real in the universe is Hashem. And even though it's not tangible, but he is the only thing which is in a certain sense real. And it's a trend in mankind, Jew and non-Jew alike, in ancient times and in current times, to try to channel powers, whether in dress and in fashion and in jewelry. And therefore, the Ram theory is that was really the rationale for the prohibition of shatness, because he saw this as a phenomenon. Or I'm going to go, how did he know? Because for him, it was a living reality 800 years ago. They would specifically his Egyptian idolatrous priests of 800 years ago would specifically make garments of wool and linen specifically. Not like, I like the feel. And they weren't just, nor so he saw, and there was an ancient belief as well, and the fact that they would hold on to the mineral indicated that this is sort of a universal trend in mankind. And the Torah is trying to help us avoid falling into, in an unknowing, unconscious way, into various traps. If you want to say, what are all the prohibitions of Torah? It's helping the Jew avoid certain known and unknown traps. The known traps is don't steal, don't murder, don't commit adultery. Well, you're helping create a just society. Give tzedakah, help people in need. And then there are certain unknown things which are more subtle, unconscious. Those are all the chukim and the prohibitions. And this is what the Rambam is presenting. So this is, I just want to share a theory, a approach, and provide a contemporary lens of why seemingly the very mysterious mitzvah of shatness, and from the Rambam, we give it a contemporary understanding of, in a certain sense, the desire for shatness of old is no different of the desire of current days of the red bindle, green bindle, chamsa, and crystals, and many more such things that create magical and personal empowerment. Any questions?
Do you think it's different if we look at, let's say, a chamsa or whatever, or not whatever, but like, let's say that as like, I guess it's interesting that we just had this discussion because I brought up the star, and honestly, in my mind, until tonight's conversation, I didn't really see a big difference between the two, because you can wear one without thinking, I mean, the chamsa, you can wear like a necklace if somebody gave it to you as a gift without thinking that it actually gives you protection. You could just, it's because of that person who's like special to you or something like that. Like, and it's a symbol of your Jewishness, the same way that the star is. Or it can, like, I don't know. What do you think of that?
Well, obviously, not everybody's conscious of everything in the exact same way and the exact same thing. In order, it becomes so ever present that people don't think about it. But if you ask why of all the possible jewelry options, why are you getting something with a hand? It's a helping hand of God to do what? To block. And they say, in order, everybody know, even the most not learned person seems to know what it's all about. It's to avoid the evil eye. Even though a person may not be immediately aware of it, but the fact is, everybody's. I don't think it's It's you know, it's not so far away. So, but that's it. So that's, we have to be, here's a key point. Every person, all people are superstitious to varying degrees. And the Torah is trying, the Torah cannot eradicate all superstition. It's an impossibility. It's an impossibility. The Torah is trying to help a person withdraw from that as much as they can. So if things were like, so like the red string, which was a noted thing of the Amorite, which to vary in all societies today, even if I'm not thinking that, but most people view it as a good, people, most people think it's a good luck thing and it'll protect you from the evil eye. Also, that assumes that the evil eye is like an external mystical force, which, you know, many Rishonim viewed, many the rabbis viewed Ayin Hara is doing things that create envy in the eye of others. In other words, I don't show off my wealth. I'm not a show off because I'm going to get people's aggression because people are always in a state of competition. And if I'm going to be showing off my success, it's going to make other people feel bad and they're going to have to attack me because they're everybody's on some level in a measure of competition with each other. So that's part of the idea. So, it's, you know, most people are not sensitive to this, but you do learning, you become sensitive.
No, this is very interesting. It certainly explains why my Puerto Rican and Lebanese coworkers wear one.
Yeah, because it has universal attraction. Something about that just feels just very comforting.
Right.
And the Torah is saying, like, you're getting your comfort from the wrong place. That's a false comfort.
No, that makes sense.
All right, guys, have a great night. Lyle Tov, thanks so much. All the best.
Bye.
Bye.